Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, while lawmakers are debating lifting a cap on slots for Maricopa County residents at the state hospital.
And a retired cop who travels the country talking to fellow officers about experiences they can't explain.
But first, there is no shortage of discussion and debate over the role of AI in education. That includes how students learn about the technology and how to use it. But my next guest says we just don't know enough about AI yet to say we know how to teach it. Justin Reich is a faculty member at MIT, where he studies online learning and how teachers learn. He's also host of the podcast The Homework Machine and recently wrote a piece in the Chronicle of Higher Education titled Stop Pretending to Know How to Teach AI. In the article, Reich quotes a guide his lab has put out for K-12 educators about using AI, which says, in part, a guidebook of tying knots will show you exactly how to tie the knots the correct way. A guidebook on AI in schools in 2025 can't possibly do that because we don't even know what the knots are, let alone how to tie them. I spoke to Reich earlier about all this, and we started with what exactly he's objecting to relative to how especially universities are teaching AI.
I object to the idea that we know what to teach students about AI or about using AI that will help them be better prepared for their futures. We do not know that yet.
So how then should schools be handling AI? Because as I don't have to tell you, like, this is a huge topic of discussion in terms of, do we allow AI? Do we not allow AI? How do we try to, if our students, we figure they're going to use it anyway, what do we do with this? So what do you think schools should be doing?
Yes, we've done this big investigative reporting project called The Homework Machine, where we interviewed 120 teachers and students across the country. And certainly one of the things we heard most from teachers was our institutions have to do something, that if they don't do something, then it pushes those pressures down onto individual teachers to figure out things on their own, and it's inconsistent between classes, and that's no good. What schools need to be doing is recognizing that there are no best practices to be found. We don't know what the right way forward is. When you have to do something and you don't know what it is to do, then you have to put yourself in a kind of experimental mindset, and a mindset really sort of shaped by humility, that like our early guesses might be wrong. So what I would encourage schools to do is to look out, look at their institutions, listen to their teachers, listen to their students, and say, all right, what's our best guess for how we might move forward? And then you're going to have to test things. You have to test policies. You have to test instructional practices and really think about them as tests. Think about them as, okay, this semester we're going to try this, and we're going to gather some evidence from before this semester, before we had this policy, and we're going to gather some evidence afterwards, and we're going to see, are teachers happier? Are students happier? Are they learning more? When we look at student work, do we really see evidence of better learning emerging? Eventually, you know, 8 years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, I hope that if we had a conversation like this, I would be able to tell you, hey, we've studied this for a while, and we have a good sense of these are some pretty good ways of using GPTs and LLMs in academic instruction, and these are some ways we should really stay away from.
That sounds like it might be challenging for schools, though. I mean, in terms of just like saying, okay, we're going to do this for some amount of time, and then we're going to do this, and then we're going to try something else. While scientifically, it seems like it would probably make sense, I just wonder if logistically and policy-wise, schools are really able to adjust quite that much.
Super hard. I'll tell you a little bit about the alternative, which I think of as a really bad alternative. Google was founded in 1996. There were other web browsers before then. Mm-hmm. And in the 90s, we developed a series of methods for teaching students how to search the web. And we now know that all of that guidance is really bad, that students who use those practices do worse on really important web challenges and web skills that we want every citizen to be able to do than people who learn more effective strategies. Those more effective strategies are called lateral reading. But the point is, we taught tens of millions of children and young adults provably ineffective ways of searching the web for decades, and we're still doing it. Google was founded in 1996, the first peer-reviewed paper with really effective methods for teaching students how to search the web was published in 2019. So that challenge took us 25 years to figure out in a really robust, scientifically rigorous way. So I completely agree that what I'm proposing is hard. My sense of the alternative is that we make a bunch of guesses. Those guesses are wrong, and we miseducate a generation of students. And that I also view as a really bad idea. The thing that we want, which is that we can quickly guess effective strategies for teaching this stuff, is unfortunately not an option. And so that's what we got to work with.
Sure.
Tough choices.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if you see this, and you referenced the example of Google, like in some way, do you see this as maybe scientific research, maybe more on the university level, where you're asking a lot of questions and you don't necessarily know the answer. You're legitimately testing hypotheses to see what is effective, what is true, what is not true. And, you know, in some of those cases, as you referenced earlier, you kind of have to lead with, I don't know, we're going to have to all figure this out together.
I think we should be totally honest with students and our colleagues that we do not know, and we're going to have to figure it out together, that the challenge is not to like look out there for best practices which don't exist because no one has come up with them yet, but to say in our local context, like we've got to do something. Teachers are telling us over and over again, we got to do something and we don't know what to do. So let's be really clear and transparent about that. The other reason to be clear and transparent about that is that we're going to make mistakes and we need to communicate to all the people in schools right now that some of what they're learning, some of the early guesses they're hearing are wrong and they need to be ready to unlearn those early ideas in 5, 8, 10, 15 years as we get better knowledge and better science about these things. And I totally agree that cultivating that kind of mindset about humility and uncertainty, it's way harder than what we can do in other subjects where we can say, hey, like we know pretty much how to teach you how to write. This is a different set of challenges that schools and universities face. And it comes at a terrible time for having these challenges. Universities are under tremendous strain from a kind of public and political backlash. Schools are under tremendous strain from the challenges they faced during the pandemic, the lingering effects of that. Like, it is a terrible time to have a giant machine released into the world that can do all the students' homework for them. But that is what happened. And so now we all need to work together to figure out how to deal with it.
So how big of a mindset change do you think it would be for schools to take the approach you're suggesting? We've talked about sort of the logistic, the practical challenges of doing it. But in terms of the mindset of not only not coming up with a set policy that they're going to stick with for a certain amount of time, but also to an extent just saying, we don't really know. And, you know, we're going to have to all figure this out. Like, is that a big change in the way people think about education and the way that schools should be operating?
It certainly is at the kind of institutional level I'm proposing. I think if you get down to the classroom level, the sort of level of teachers and instructors, if you would be like, hey, do you sometimes change your practice? Do you teach in a different way from one year to the next? And do you see whether or not the new thing you're trying is better than the old thing? I don't think most teachers would be like, whoa, you're talking crazy talk, Professor Reich. Like, that is, what is this? They'd be like, yes, of course, we're professionals. That's what we do from year to year. Also, everyone who has been teaching, you know, for 6 years or longer has an extraordinary experience of, you know, this is essentially what we did instantaneously and system-wide during the pandemic.
Are there schools that you have found that have taken this approach already?
No, not in the kind of systematic way. No, I think most schools, I mean, I think the reason why I'm talking and writing like this is I think most schools are in the stage of saying either we have to find some best practices or we have to wait for some best practices to come out. I mean, this is like a pretty standard way of thinking about adaptation and change in schools. Is this idea that like somebody's going to figure this out pretty soon. And once they do, we'll just take what they figure out and we'll incorporate it into our system. And I would just caution most institutions that we are quite possibly a really long time frame away from being able to say, we pretty much have figured this one out.
All right. That is Justin Reich, among other things, with the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Justin, thanks so much for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
More young people today are being diagnosed with cancer. And that means more cancer patients are learning that their cancer treatments could leave them childless in the future.
Radiation and chemotherapy can cause infertility, and for our next guest this morning, the news was just an added shock on top of the fact that she learned she had breast cancer at age 27. And treatments to protect your fertility can be expensive.
Katie Asher is a physical therapist at Barrow Neurological Institute in Phoenix, and she testified before the state legislature recently in support of a new bill that would require insurers to cover fertility treatments for cancer patients in a situation like this.
When you're diagnosed with cancer, you don't have the luxury of time. I was still trying to process the shock of hearing the word cancer. I felt scared, overwhelmed, and like the future I imagined for myself was being ripped away. And suddenly, on top of all of that, I had to make a rushed decision about my future family. As someone who works in healthcare, I see every day that survival is not the only goal. We want patients to live full, meaningful lives after treatment, and that includes the possibility of building a family one day. No one fighting for their life should also have to worry about whether they can afford to preserve their family in the future.
Our co-host, Lauren Gilger, spoke with her more about it.
I want to begin for our listeners, Katie, with your story. I mean, you were diagnosed with breast cancer at a very young age. Tell us first just like about that initial shock. Like, I don't think any 27-year-old is expecting that diagnosis.
Not at all. When I first felt the lump myself, I went to my doctor in November the year before, and my doctor just thought it was like dense breast tissue, said we would watch it. And then I had a couple conversations with some of my classmates from physical therapy school who actually had biopsies of their own breasts after feeling a lump, and all of theirs came back benign. So when I felt mine, I didn't even tell my mom about it until the night before. And luckily, she ended up coming to my appointment with me, but I went in for an ultrasound, which immediately turned into a mammogram, and they had an opening for a biopsy later that day. So I actually got all the testing done the same day. And then I got my results at 5:20 p.m. the next day. So it happened really, really quickly. And
Wow. It
was definitely immediate shock. I really was expecting to be just like my other friends, where it was nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And took the next day off of work, and we called a bunch of surgeons. I had an appointment the day after that, where everything was set into motion. After that, the path for me was chemo, especially being so young. So I had the most aggressive form of chemo. But before even starting chemo, my oncologist made it a point to make it be known that doing chemo can cause infertility. So while I still had my drains in from my double mastectomy, I was going through the egg freezing process, which was very interesting.
Wow. Okay. So you're still recovering from this massive surgery, kind of reeling from the shock of even being diagnosed with cancer at such a young age. And then you have to make this big decision about your future fertility. Like, had you ever thought about whether or not you wanted kids? Was this part of your plan?
I knew I always wanted kids. Yeah. But I never thought that having to freeze my eggs was something that would be in my future.
Mm-hmm.
It was a huge shock to not only have to figure out, like, physically, there are so many changes after having that surgery, and then to have to be like, okay, now I have to start doing shots for myself. And I knew that I would want the option to have kids in the future. And looking at the price tag, it was really, really staggering. But my parents were there the whole time and ensured that whatever it took, that they would be there to support me financially through that.
Wow, yeah.
And then luckily the clinic that I went to has an oncology program too. So they were able to subsidize the medications too. So that was a huge deal.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. So you got some help in paying for this, but not everyone is going to be in that situation. How much can it cost? I mean, like you said, this is a kind of an extensive process to go through fertility treatments to then extract and freeze your eggs, but it's also a really expensive one.
Very expensive. Yeah. Our total cost out of pocket with the subsidized medications was still $6,000.
Wow.
But with the medications, I've heard coworkers talk that it can be up to $20,000 to do the entire process. You're going in for ultrasounds and blood work almost every single day so they can track your hormones. They know when the retrieval has to happen. And there's a lot of monitoring appointments within that. So it's a very expensive process. And then in addition to that, every year it's $625 to maintain the storage. So for me, I had purchased a home just 6 months before that. So all my money that I had saved pretty much, I had reinvested into a home because at 27 years old, I didn't think that I would have to save all this for a medical reason. So yeah, there's no way I would have been able to cover that any other way.
So now you're advocating for this particular bill at the Arizona State Legislature. You're doing work with this organization, the CHIC Mission, this national nonprofit that is working to pass policies just like these. And it sounds like it's because this is more common than people might think. The rate of cancer in young people is rising, right?
Correct. Yeah. And a lot of research is going into the why behind that, but it is pretty staggering to look at the numbers of how many people between the ages of 25 and 35 or 40 that are being diagnosed. And normal screening doesn't happen until 40 anyway. So a lot of times people are getting diagnosed at much later stages than they would if they were older because it's caught earlier if you're doing regular screening. So not only is it the rate of young people getting diagnosed is going up, but also the severity and how aggressive the tumor is at the time of diagnosis for a young woman.
So it sounds like other states are passing bills like this successfully. And I wonder, like, is it the case that doctors often or always let patients know that this might be a problem, that like your doctor did, will say, you know, by the way, as we're dealing with this cancer treatment and you need to go through chemotherapy, you also should keep in mind that you might not be able to have kids one day because of it.
I was very, very fortunate to have an oncologist that prioritized that because the more stories that I hear of young women that are getting diagnosed is that their doctors aren't even mentioning it. I've heard other stories too of young men who are diagnosed with testicular cancer who are never told that they would have to freeze their sperm in order to have kids in the future. So they end up going through surgery and then that option is gone. So I don't know what work is being done on the oncology side of things to have these conversations with people, but that's another branch that the CHIC Mission focuses on is education. So making sure young women know that this is something to advocate for in the future if this does happen.
This is a bill that puts the onus of the payment on the insurance companies. Have you gotten pushback from insurance companies from that industry about having to pay for this?
Yeah, I can touch on in Arizona. I don't know nationally what the response has been, but from speaking with the lobbyists that we've been working with here, as the bill was being drafted, we did have individual meetings with the major insurance providers in Arizona. And the biggest pushback was mostly the requirement for insurance companies to cover the storage part of that for 3 years after the initial cycle. So we changed the verbiage of the bill to be 3 plan years. That was big for the insurance companies. And then we were really advocating for that 3 year mark just because at 1 year, which is what they were also wanting, 1 year post all of this, as a cancer survivor, you're still reeling in what does my life look like now post-cancer? So being able to have that 3 year wiggle room to be able to get back on your feet, emotionally, physically, financially, is a really important aspect of this bill as well.
So you are cancer-free now, is that right?
I am, yes. We do monitoring appointments every 3 months through blood work, but so far, so good.
Well, congratulations. I wonder,
Thank you.
I want to ask you lastly, Katie, about something that you said in your testimony in front of the Arizona State Legislature. You said that because you are a healthcare practitioner, right? Like you work in this field, and you said that you know that survival is not the only goal. What was your goal in all of this?
I think during it, survival for me was the only goal because I think for a lot of people who get faced with the word cancer, the thing that pops into our heads is that it could be a terminal diagnosis and there's so much uncertainty. So in the thick of it was survival. But I think now, especially that I'm 3 years post, I'm seeing that getting back into what my new normal is and finding purpose and passion and being able to be a voice for people in the future who will face the same thing, it really expands your horizons and makes you think about what's really important in life.
Yeah. All right. That is Katie Asher, a physical therapist at Barrow Neurological Institute, cancer survivor, and a volunteer with the CHIC mission, joining us to talk about this potential law here in Arizona. Katie, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it. Congratulations on being cancer free.
Thank you so much.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, it's not often easy to find a great love, especially in your 40s. For one corporate consultant and life coach, it took a confrontation with herself to open up to meaningful change.
In doing so, you learn what you like, what you don't like. You learn about your boundaries. You learn about, even in the future, it taught me what kinds of things I wanted to look for in a future partner, even though that's not really what the story ended up being about.
We'll hear more about what she learned along the way to a soulmate.
But first, Marianne Robb retired from the Gilbert Police Department in 2021 after 34 years in law enforcement. But she is still working with police officers. A few years ago, she and another former officer, Dave Rich, started an organization they call UAPPD, the Unidentified Anomalous Phenomena Police Department. They take reports from cops and other law enforcement officers who have experiences they can't explain. This work is not new for Rob. She's been actively involved in the Arizona chapter of MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, since 2015. And as she told me recently, even back when she was on the police force, fellow officers would call her when their investigations intersected with the paranormal.
I had a case where the family thought the sister was mentally ill because she said that she was going to marry a entity or an alien from another planet, and his name was Lucifer, and that she was going to meet him one night, and he was going to take her and her two kids up to his planet and live happily ever after.
Oh, boy.
My partner goes, hey, can you come with me on this? Because I don't know how to react to this. So I got there, come to find out. She actually was headed to a very dark area the night before at like midnight. And it's up near Sunflower, Arizona. And if anybody knows that area, it is probably the darkest spot that I have seen in a very long time. And it was her and her two small young kids. She was there for half the night, waiting for Lucifer to come down and take her up to his planet. Well, he never showed. My thought that really kind of concerned me was, what happens if Lucifer did not want kids? What would have happened to those two kids out in the middle of nowhere? So I spoke to the lady, and we sat down, and she was telling me this whole story. Well, then she started talking about Stephen Greer, and she started to talk about all these other organizations that's part of this UFO thing. Well, I knew what she was talking about. Whether I believed in the people that she was talking about, that didn't matter. I knew what she was talking about. And she got so comfortable. She held my hand and she literally got up, voluntarily walked up, it got into my patrol car, and we took her to go get a psych evaluation. Now, if it would have been my partner or if it had been any other officer that doesn't know the key words or didn't know the people she was talking about, oh, there'd be a fight on their hands.
Boy, so that's a complex story, Marianne. Thank you for sharing that. Let me just make sure I understand. You took the step in your mind to consider the idea that she sincerely believed in Lucifer.
Yes.
And that if her version of the story was true, there might be a case that these kids would get abandoned. So by taking that step, because you were immersed in this world, you were able to kind of meet her where she was and ask her a question that made her comfortable enough to go get a psych evaluation.
Correct. I'm looking at her body language. I'm looking in her eyes. I'm hearing what she has to say in her mind. She is 100% telling me the truth. Do I believe all that happened? No. But I'm going to make her feel that, yes, I believe her, and I'm going to give her any kind of help that she needs.
This seems like a really critical difference you just identified. Is someone telling the truth versus do they believe they're telling the truth?
My first priority at that point was, you know what? I'm here with you. Let's get you some help.
Let me ask you this, Marianne. As I understand it, sometimes officers themselves have these unexplainable experiences, right?
Oh, yes.
Not just yes. They get calls about other people having them.
Oh, no. There is a lot of officers and first responders that have had these type of experiences, and they have no clue what to do, where to go. We have officers and first responders. Now, when we say law enforcement, we're talking state, local, county, federal, any kind, park rangers, all of these different categories are out there, you know, working either 24-hour shifts, working 10-hour shifts, out in, you know, under the big open sky.
And so what do you and Dave do once people bring these stories to you? Do you then liaise with the departments, or how does the collaboration work?
No, because most of these officers, whether or not they are still on duty or they're retired, there is a lot of officers that don't want to be identified. They just want to share their story, get it out there, and have someone reassure them they are not crazy. Hmm. This stuff happens. Hmm. And it just relaxes them. Do we have answers for them? No. But that's not what we're here for. We're here to help them to navigate whatever the situation was and to reassure them they are not crazy. They saw something.
So it's almost, and I mean this in a good way, it's almost like therapy.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is, because we want them to understand that there is a what we call a quote-unquote safe zone where they can come and share. Now, when we get numerous officers that have experienced something in one specific location, which we have had, we'll go out and maybe do somewhat of investigation. Hey, can we see something? We had about 8 stories with this one location.
Hmm.
So we decided, okay, we're going to go check it out. Mm-hmm. And I had a video camera, and I'm just kind of just videotaping. Dave and I have a couple other folks that are on our team. One is kind of a ghost hunter, has all the equipment, and one is a kind of a medium.
Mm-hmm.
She is very sensitive in that fashion. She's also a hypnotherapist, and mm-hmm. she's kind of our therapist if anybody would like to talk to her. So the four of us are out there, and all of a sudden, just as we're getting ready to leave, Dave and this gal that were with Gwen, they see something. And I just got my video camera, and I'm freehanding this, and I'm looking and kind of zooming in to where they says they're seeing something. And Dave goes, I just have the sense we need to leave. So we all get in the truck. We leave. We go to a restaurant just to get something to eat and kind of debrief a little bit. And I'm looking at my video camera. And I'm looking at this, and I'm kind of seeing something. Didn't say a word to him. I said, Dave, just look at this. See what you think. And he goes, holy cow. And he showed it to the other two people. And there was one tall being or something standing there. And then there was another one, all fours, that was kind of doing, you know, going back and forth, trying to figure out who we were kind of thing. Gwen saw it. Jesse saw it. Dave saw it. He could not explain it.
So these folks that come to you and they say, I have this experience, I need you guys to hear me out. Do they pay you for that?
Oh, no. No, no, no.
You're not doing it for money.
No, we're doing it on our own dime.
Uh-huh.
I just traveled to Utah because we had a Bigfoot experience that this officer, even though he's retired, he still wanted to remain anonymous. So he goes, if you want my story, you need to come up to Utah. Well, guess who found a hotel and off to Utah? And I drive because I have my equipment and everything, so I'll drive. So again, on my own dime, I drove up to Utah to get the story. I will travel wherever I need to go to meet with that person.
Well, I have been speaking with Marianne Robb, a retired Gilbert police officer and the co-founder of the UAP PD. Marianne, thank you for this conversation.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Good morning. You're listening to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. The state Senate has approved a bill that would lift the cap on the number of beds available to Maricopa County residents at the Arizona State Hospital. That cap has been in place for more than a decade after the state settled a long-running lawsuit known as Arnold v. Sarn. The suit alleged the state was not providing adequate care for residents with serious mental illnesses. Will Humble is the executive director of the Arizona Public Health Association. He was the head of the state health department who signed off on the settlement back in 2014. He joins me now to talk more about the idea of lifting the cap. Will, good morning.
Morning, Mark.
So tell me about your decision to sign this settlement in the first place that instituted this cap.
Yeah. So as you know, the Arnold versus Sarn lawsuit was exactly like you described, that Arizona was doing a super bad job helping people with mental illness get treatment back in the 80s and 90s. And there was a stipulation agreement in 1995 that Governor Simonton's team signed that capped the number of treatment beds at the Arizona State Hospital Civil Unit at 55. And it stayed that way. Well, it's still that way.
Yeah.
And then when we did the settlement agreement under Governor Brewer in 2014, I signed the agreement that said, okay, we'll limit the number of treatment beds at the Arizona State Hospital for Maricopa County residents to just 55. I knew it was a bad idea, but the overall bigger settlement was really worth it because we got performance measures in place and accountability in place for even future administrations around treatment for folks with serious mental illness. So I agreed to the 55 cap. So mea culpa there.
Yeah. But so now you are supportive of the effort to lift the cap. Is it mostly a matter of there are more than 55 Maricopa County residents who could benefit from the services that they would get at the state hospital?
Yeah, way more. Arizona, if you look nationally at the number of inpatient psychiatric treatment facilities, beds, you might say, Arizona is at the very bottom of the list. So we need a lot more treatment capacity and secure environments for people under court-order treatment for serious mental illnesses, in my opinion. There's other people that disagree with me, but I've ran the system, I know, and it's gotten a lot worse since I left. So, yeah, so that's the situation now.
How much of a dent would this put in? Like, do you have a sense of, like, this isn't going to – like everybody who needs this kind of help won't be able to go there, even if they lift the cap, right?
Right. No. Right. If you lift the Maricopa County cap, that would allow people who really need treatment in Maricopa County who are stuck at like Valleywise, and Valleywise does good work, but the secure environments that they have are really hospital type environment, like small hospital type environments. Where at the Arizona State Hospital, it's a more therapeutic, or at least has the resources to be more therapeutic for people. So it would allow the transfer of people from the Valleywise system into the Arizona State Hospital. But to your point, it doesn't solve the overarching problem, which is the lack of capacity for this kind of treatment. And by the way, the discharge capacity. So if you have people at the civil unit with a serious mental illness who need to get discharged to another environment that's more secure, like a secure residential facility, we don't even have those. Hmm. So there's lots of problems in the system. This would provide some help.
What would it take to make this workable? I assume that, assuming, let's say the bill passes, the governor signs it, I assume you don't just snap your fingers tomorrow, the state hospital can let in a bunch more people from Maricopa County.
Correct. Yeah, good point. Good question. So, yeah. By the way, at the Arizona State Hospital, the civil unit, that's the folks that we're talking about here, there are some empty floors because of the 55 cap. So there's actual physical space to provide a lot more, dozens more treatment capacity for people with a psychiatric illness like this at the Arizona State Hospital. But they have to be staffed. So you'd have to fund it, the extra.
And that staff is not there now.
No, that staff's not there now. So you'd have to fund the ability for staff to come in and provide that kind of treatment. So it'd be like an 8-month sort of landing pad where you could get the state resources in place, increase the amount of capacity that's available for that kind of treatment out at Ash, and then by opening up those floors on Ironwood. That's the name of the building.
Okay. Is there a danger that by lifting this cap, it would violate the terms of the settlement that you signed?
Well, so as you mentioned, I signed and Governor Brewer signed the settlement agreement in 2014, and the 55 cap was in that. But if the state legislature passed, and by the way, there's no 55 cap in state law. It's just a settlement agreement. So if the legislature passes a bill that says, hey, you could go beyond 55 for Maricopa County residents, then and even fund it, let's say, then you know the plaintiffs may, in the Arnold versus Sarnes suit, go to the judge and say, hey, look, they violated the settlement agreement, Your Honor, and make them stop. And that's the so there would be probably some court appearance, but the state could say, hey, look, the legislature passed this bill. That settlement agreement was 10 years ago when the population of Arizona was a lot less than it is today. We need this treatment capacity. We're in accord with all of the other performance measures in the Arnold versus Sarn agreement. Your Honor, we would like you to amend the stipulation agreement or settlement agreement.
Right. Well, so the original 55, was that I'm curious why that was put in place. I know that all of that sort of predates your time at the health department. But I'm wondering, like, was there a thought that if you didn't put a cap on the number of residents of Maricopa County at ASH, that residents of other parts of the state wouldn't be able to get in?
I just don't know that part of it. I wasn't in the I was doing food safety at the time.
Right.
So
right.
I wasn't like in the room where these things were discussed at the time. But in general, the plaintiff class, the people who sued the state, were really concerned that people were being institutionalized too quickly. And so this was a mechanism to like hardwire a cap on that because the lawsuit was about Maricopa County. So it just applied to Maricopa County people.
Okay. So, well, very quickly before I let you go, this bill is going to, as I mentioned, it cleared the Senate. It's going before a House committee next week. What's your level of optimism that it'll pass that committee?
I think it'll pass the committee. I think there's a really good chance that it'll pass on the floor of the House. It passed in the Senate with bipartisan support. What I don't get a sense is where the governor is, whether she'd sign it or not. I don't know. I think she should if it gets to her desk, but I'm not the governor.
Right.
She is.
Okay, fair enough. That is Will Humble, Executive Director of the Arizona Public Health Association. Will, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Dr. Corey C. Miller travels the world speaking at conferences and events. She's a Tucson-based life coach and corporate consultant specializing in leadership. Companies often hire her for her research-driven insights on how to run their businesses more effectively. But several years ago, she found herself confronting the reality that she wasn't running her personal life as effectively as she wanted. C. Miller was just a few weeks removed from a breakup with her long-term partner. One day, she was cleaning her house with her daughter when friends started messaging her. Her ex had posted a photo on social media announcing she was in a new relationship. C. Miller was crushed. She remembers her 12-year-old daughter taking her by the arm and telling her that everything would be okay. But C. Miller wasn't so sure. She was in her 40s and felt like time was running out to find her soulmate. So she decided to do what she advises her clients to do, make a plan and execute it. She tells the story of what happened next in her new memoir, The Soulmate Strategy.
In my professional life, in my personal life too, but I'm very type A. So every problem has a solution. I move quickly. I'm efficient, you know, and this works great in the professional world. And I thought, what if I use this in my kind of romantic world, right? Could I move quickly through this if I was just much more strategic rather than sitting around and crying about it?
So tell us a little bit about what some of these things were that people were sending you or that you were finding. Were there any of them that you were trepidatious about where you thought like, I'm not the kind of person who does that?
Well, I had someone sending me information about the law of attraction and manifesting. I was a little nervous about it, but I decided to lean in and I joined a manifesting group and we met on Monday nights and we would share our manifests with each other. And the more I was involved in it and realized other people were trying to do the same thing with manifesting, the more excited I got about it.
Huh.
Because whether people believe in manifesting from a spiritual perspective or even just a practical perspective, if you don't know what you want, it's very hard to go out and then try to find it.
Right. Well, see, that's very interesting to me, Corey, because, you know, you were describing yourself as very type A earlier. And please feel free to disagree with me, but I think of the law of attraction as a sort of I don't know, quasi-mystical, somewhat spiritual idea, this idea that, you know, by putting your intentions out into the world, it draws things to you. What was it like for you to experience these kind of, I don't know, like inverse outcomes as compared to, you know, the type of person that you think of yourself as?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, it was fascinating. I didn't even realize this till sort of the end of the book. It was one of my epiphanies, was that I really, really wanted to do things that were more flow state and things that would allow me to let go of control. But what I was doing was I was trying to control letting go of control. And it was such an irony. And I mean, there were some points in the book where my close friend in there, she continues to say, like, you can't control this. That's the whole point of it. And you can't use manifests as a checklist. You really have to let it go into the universe. And I'm like, well, if I don't want to let it go into the universe because I don't trust what's going to happen. And so it was like there was a point in which my type A personality was competing with my let it go personality. I actually named these alter egos in the book. I called them the general, which was the type A personality, which was just constantly telling me what to do. And then the other was this Zen master, this idea like just let it go, be at peace. And these two parts of my personality just kept fighting the whole way through. Yeah. I wanted to be more Zen. I wanted to let go. I wanted to have more flow. But I was just strangleholding it the whole time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you also tried some other less practical things like crystals at one point.
Yes, I did. I love crystals.
Tell us about your experience with love crystals.
Well, I decided to go in and buy a whole bunch of things. And so I bought rose quartz for love, and I did all this stuff, and I got home and I was, you know, told to hold them in my hand and think, you know, thoughts of my future love. And I just ended up with a sweaty palm. I'm like, I don't know. I mean, but then again, you know, maybe they worked and I just didn't know. It would have been worse without them, but nothing remarkable happened.
Well, one of the reasons I'm curious about these various attempts, Corey, is that something I have a sense of you doing as you make these efforts is not just making your way to, you know, finding a person, but also it seems like getting to know new parts of yourself.
Oh, 100%. I was terrified of rappelling, but had sort of accidentally agreed to rappel with someone that I wanted to impress, and ended up really liking that. So I think I pushed myself a little bit kind of to the edge, both sort of spiritually and emotionally, as well as physically. And I'm grateful because that attitude, that yes attitude of, sure, I'll try it. That whole process of saying yes to things was actually what healed me.
Right, right. I mean, I think that's such an important takeaway from your story in my mind, is that even if, you know, somebody listening to this is skeptical about something like love crystals or the law, which I hear you are as well, but or the law, the law of attraction or whatever, it seems like the deeper message there is that if you want something meaningful in your life to change, you have to open the door to parts of yourself that you've kind of prevented yourself from engaging with.
Exactly. And in doing so, you learn what you like, what you don't like. You learn about your boundaries. You learn about, even in the future, it taught me what kinds of things I wanted to look for in a future partner, even though that's not really what this story ended up being about.
One of the other things I know was important to you with this is that this isn't just a memoir. It is explicitly in description an LGBTQ memoir. And as I understand it, it was important to you to write about the lesbian experience in a way that you had not seen it validated or reflected in other stories. Can you talk a little bit about what you mean by that and what you were attempting to do here specifically to counteract that?
Heartbreak is universal. Healing is universal. Love is universal, at least the quest for those things. It doesn't matter. It cuts across all types of demographics. Yet when I was struggling, I wanted to find some protagonist that felt like me and see them be okay. And I couldn't find anything. The books and the resources we have in the LGBT community are quite broad, but you know, you get mostly things about self-help, about coming out, or you get really, really traumatic memoirs about horrible things that have happened to people by virtue of their sexual orientation. And those are also very important contributions to the literary community. There was sort of nothing in the middle that felt like it just normalized same-sex relationships. The second part of it, though, was that while it is normalizing it for people, there are still many, many people who identify in this community that are in the closet and don't feel safe talking about their experiences. And so this happened to me with my first relationship where we didn't tell anybody we were in a relationship. And after nearly 2 years of being together, we split up and I was heartbroken. And because we hadn't told anyone we were together, I couldn't tell anyone we were apart. And I felt so alone. So I know there's people out there that might be having a relationship with someone and they're not out to anyone and they have no support if something with that relationship goes awry. And maybe they can pick up my book and they can say, okay, I see myself here. I'm going to be okay. Corey's in my corner here. Mm-hmm. And so in the one sense, it normalizes our experience. But in another sense, it hits a niche of people that really need to have some validation.
Well, I have been speaking with Dr. Corey C. Miller, the author of the new book, The Soulmate Strategy, My Imperfect Plan to Conquer Heartbreak and Find True Love. Dr. C. Miller, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me on.
And that'll do it for this Tuesday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. Remember to sign up for the show's weekly newsletter. It is called Radio Heads. You can sign up at theshow.kjzz.org. You know what else is a good follow, Sam?
Tell me.
On Instagram, KJZZ The Show.
Ooh, Instagram.
A good follow, as the kids say.
I've heard that many people use this app. I should really investigate it one of these days.
Absolutely. All right. For Sam Dingman and Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. Have a great rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman.